When did you get in town?
Thursday. Yes, I'm still a little mixed up. My clock is a little mixed up, yes.
Yeah, probably suffering a little bit of jet lag.
Yeah, yeah, I wake up early, which is very rare for me. I'm a very late, lazy person, but...
Well, today was an interesting day. There's the Von Steuben Day Parade marching up Fifth Avenue.
Yes, we saw it. Mm.
And a whole raft of street fairs and street closings. And I live in Manhattan. I drove down, I had to go down to the Strand bookstore this morning and run some errands, and I made the mistake of taking my car.
Mm.
And I must have been on the local streets for 2 hours trying to get around parades, street fairs. It's not like that in London, is it?
Well, when there's a street fair or parade, you mean? we very rarely have things like that.
You would think that on a Saturday there would not be as much chaos as there is in the city.
There's chaos every... the traffic situation is terrible in London. The problem you seem to have here is that you've got a lot of traffic. But the problem in London is that the streets aren't really geared for major city traffic. So it's an infrastructural problem.
And it's on a little island.
Mm.
That's terrible. Of course, in London, you have to go around IRA bombing sites a lot.
So. Yes. But what you might think IRA bombing sites, it's just really people digging up the road, and it takes them 3 months to do a job that the Germans or the Japanese were doing 2 nights. Yeah. And so, yeah, it looks like a bomb site when you're driving around.
Well, it's incredible in this town. Driving today, there are bulldozers and cranes. And some of them have been on the same stretch of street for weeks, and I always make the mistake of going up that same stretch of street.
Mm-hmm.
And inevitably, it narrows to one lane, and a fire truck will come.
Mm.
And it's just chaotic. So I'm exhausted. I'm ready to go home now. Well, you're just starting. How long will you be in the States?
On Monday I start a kind of a cross-country tour, which will go on for the best part of 2 weeks. And so I'll be taking in Midwest and West Coast.
Well, this is not your first trip to the United States. You were here, I believe, a year or so ago on the hardcover.
Yeah, I've been here since then as well. I was in Houston for some odd reason about 4 months ago.
Oh, why is that's my hometown. What is the odd reason?
Oh, well, it's not such an odd reason. There was some kind of a... do you know the Houston International Festivals?
No, I don't.
No, I think that's a recent thing. There used to be a Houston festival. Do you remember that? Or maybe that was a very small thing. But they've tried to expand this annual festival to make it a kind of an international festival. And the theme this year was Great Britain. They take a kind of a country as a kind of a theme each year. I think last year it was France. Next year it's Japan. And so they invited people from Great Britain. And I was representing British literature or something. But... It didn't quite come together, the festival. I think they've maybe been a little too ambitious in expanding it to a large
format. I was there last in July in time for the International Summit, and every time I drove, I would encounter Margaret Thatcher's motorcade.
Mm-hmm.
So even Houston was chaotic. Mm-hmm. I haven't lived there since I was a child, but my family still lives there.
Well, it must have changed enormously from that time. I mean.
It's huge.
Yes, and all this
seems to go on for miles.
And all those skyscrapers, presumably they weren't there when you were going.
Yes,
they were.
I left in the late 1940s, but it was on a post-war building boom then, and so every block there were new buildings going up. So yes, the expansion of Houston did start right after the war.
Mm.
Well, let's talk about you and talk about your work. I've enjoyed both of these books. They were wonderful, wonderful books. Maybe before we talk about the books, we'll talk a little bit about your background and how it came to pass that you became an author. You were born in Japan.
Yes, I was born in Japan in 1954, and I came to England, or I should say I went to England, since I'm here in the States, in 1960. So I was almost six. And then I had a more or less straightforward kind of British upbringing as far as school and friends were concerned.
Well, why did your family move to England?
Well, nothing terribly exciting. My father is, or was, anyway, he's retired now, a research scientist. And his project was being sponsored by the British government at that time. He's an oceanographer, and I think there was a lot going on in the North Sea. where the British have found oil, of course. And so it wasn't an emigration. It was a temporary visit for perhaps 2 years. And in the way these things happen, it was extended for another year and another year. And so it was a strange sort of way of actually changing country. And I think my parents certainly didn't adopt the mentality of immigrants. They were always visitors who preserved their Japaneseness. And to a certain extent, I suppose, you know, try to bring their children up in preparation for growing up in Japan, ultimately, and not in England. And so for this reason, I think I grew up with a certain distance on the society around me, that's to say British society around me. Although in many ways, you know, outside of the home, I was getting a very typical Southern England, middle-class kind of education and upbringing.
Did your parents speak Japanese in the home?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, today...
So that was your first language?
First language in the sense that it's the first language I learned, but I'm much more competent with English. I have trouble when I encounter Japanese who are strangers, because although I can make myself understood, Japanese is a fantastically complicated language in terms of social nuance. You know, you have to, it's a complete opposite to American English in that sense. You have to choose a different vocabulary depending on how you perceive the relative status of the person you're speaking to. And to get this wrong is terrible. I mean, it's unforgivable. So I always freeze up if I'm introduced to a Japanese person. I try to keep it to English.
You were about six when you went to Great Britain?
Yeah, I was five and a half.
So you at that time did not speak English?
I didn't speak English, but I don't recall a time when I actually couldn't speak English. I think when you're that age, you're just picking up things so fast. And obviously there must have been a kind of a hiatus period when I couldn't handle the language, but I certainly don't remember ever struggling to make myself understood. And my parents tell me, you know, very rapidly, I was speaking very fluently in English.
I've always wondered how children who grow up in a bilingual household, or a household that's primarily a single language household, but is exposed to a second language, how he separates the two languages.
Yeah,
it would seem to me that a child like that would intersperse words from each language in trying to communicate.
Well, that happened. But obviously, in my situation, the stronger language was English. The only people I had any contact with who spoke Japanese were members of my immediate family. So it was the Japanese that became invaded and contaminated by English. And so, well, this is the other problem I have. I find it very difficult to utter a sentence in Japanese without mixing English words into it.
Because this children is a habit are under an enormous peer pressure to be like the other children. So when you would go out, when we go to school or to play, I would assume that you would want to be like the rest of them.
Yeah, and obviously I would speak English. I mean, no question about it. You know, I would just speak English. And very rapidly, as I say, by the time I was six or seven, nobody would be able to detect any accent or anything like that in the way I spoke English. I spoke English like anybody else.
Now, I believe you said a moment ago that you had a rather typical English upbringing. But I wonder about that to a degree, being a Japanese, and the English have a reputation of being rather insulated in some respects and aloof and somewhat suspicious of other people. They're not like Americans where everybody comes from someplace else. So did you ever have the feeling that perhaps you were an outsider?
I didn't. I've often wondered about this because recently, of course, in England, this whole question of multiculturalism, multiracialism in the society has become one of the kind of burning issues. I'm often asked this sort of question. But when I was growing up in the south of England, that kind of tension between ethnic minority communities and the mainstream white community, that hadn't really come to a burning point. And also because I was Japanese, I didn't fit into any obvious category as a foreigner. So I think what I learned to do very quickly was and unconsciously as a child, was to... well, what I learned was that I was always different. I was very conspicuous. I was often the only foreign-looking kid in the whole place. In any room, in any school, I would be the only kid who was actually not straight white English. And I realized that this is something I could use for myself or against myself. But it was almost like being on stage. Very rapidly, you had to establish whether the audience was on your side or against you. And there was no sort of neutral ground. And I think I must have assimilated that very quickly.
Because how did you accomplish the feat of getting them on your side?
I'm not quite sure, but I've always had the English on my side. And it's gone right on into my literary career. I've had one of the easiest rides any author can have in recent English literary terms. I'm not quite sure. I mean, it's something I suppose I learned to do as a child. I mean, it helped that when I was a child, I was relatively large. Right, but after puberty, a Japanese kid actually starts to get relatively small to his English counterparts. And now, I'm 5'6". I'm smaller than the average Westerner. But often Japanese kids of 5, 6, 7, they're actually much better built and actually quite chunky and large compared to their Western counterparts. And so it was often just brute strength. I was just stronger than most of my friends. And then there was this kind of myth that because I was Oriental, I had all these mysterious martial arts powers.
And the feeling also that Asians are much more intelligent than Westerners.
Well, my upbringing in England predated anything like that. Nobody had any preconceptions about me. There was no precedent. Often, they just didn't know. I was quite a sweet-looking kid. And the verdict was out. I had to actually, I was the first person they had encountered like this, and they had to sort of establish whether they liked me or they didn't like me. I didn't have this whole kind of a previous record set by other people, other foreigners before me to contend with. So now I look at a lot of people today, a lot of younger friends of mine, perhaps maybe just 10 years younger, who are not what you might call white, straight, white English, Anglo-Saxon, British people. And I think they've had a much more complicated upbringing, particularly people who come from Asian backgrounds, in the waves of immigration from India and Pakistan to Britain. There they have to actually make a choice between the actual minority community that actually exists within Britain and the mainstream community. And I suppose this is something that Americans are perhaps much more mature about, although I'm sure the same kind of tensions and frictions face people from growing up in ethnic minorities.
Well, there is
in
a
American
fear
cities,
in this country that people can lose their ethnic identity, and so there is a feeling that, for example, the von Steuben Day Parade is an example where people are proud of being German and they want to salute and celebrate it, but the fact of the matter is that our population does assimilate and scatters, and so we have fewer and fewer what we call ghettos, so concentrations of people.
But I think this is one of the really interesting challenges now of our day. I think everywhere the tendency to equate race with citizenship is breaking down. In almost every major country now, people are having to re-examine what these notions mean, things like citizenship, nationality. The whole question of multiculturalism is breaking out all over the world. Everyone's having to redefine what it actually means to be British or German. And even the Japanese, I noticed, possibly the last major country to have to face this question. For the first time now, they're beginning to ask these questions about what is the relationship of the mainstream Japanese community to non-Japanese people living in Japan. It's a complete opposite to the United States. When you go to a place like, say, Kyoto, or you will not see anybody other than people who look Japanese. But there's now, you know, the 20th century is now catching up with them, and there are a lot of workers coming in from Southeast Asia and mainland China, and they're having to, and of course a lot of Westerners are now moving into Japan, and they're facing this question now as well. And I think this is the way the world is going. This is the age of people losing their labels and having to find new ones.
That's going to happen in an age of the Concorde, the fax, and the Macintosh. It's inevitable.
Yeah.
It's interesting that your first two books were set in Japan for the most part, and yet you had not been in Japan since you were a very young child. How did you get this feeling? I mean, when I read A Pale View of Hills, I felt as though I were in Nagasaki.
Well, people often ask me how much research did I have to do and things like that. What happened was I had to always do what amounted to research all the way through my childhood, naturally, long before I ever dreamt of writing a book. What happened was because I was taken away from Nagasaki and Japan at an early age, I was separated from a whole way of life and colors and textures and scenery that I remembered, and obviously was very attached to, as well as people who were very close to me, like my grandparents. I came to England where I was a very happy kid, but of course I always thought about Japan, this country that I had left and I believed I would actually return to. And so all the way through my growing up, throughout and right into my teenage years, there was this alternative world that I thought about and constructed in my head. And my parents would tell me about Japan. I would be sent books about Japan. And I would have these memories of Japan. And so all through my growing up, I just because of my circumstances, I was building an imaginary world in my head. A world that's a mixture of imagination and memory and speculation, I guess. And I think by the time I was in my mid-20s, I started to realize that this Japan, which was very precious to me, probably didn't correspond to any real country I would find if I got onto an aeroplane and landed in this airport labeled Tokyo or whatever. That it was a precious country that existed only in my head and in my heart, I suppose. And I also realized that with every year that went by, it was getting fainter and fainter. And I think I had a great need to put it down on paper and structure it. And so I think that's what drove me to actually writing novels in the first place. So it wasn't really the case that I said to myself, right, I want to write a novel, I'll set it here in this place, I better go and find out about it. I had this world that had built up within me, and eventually it found its expression in a book.
At the same token, you're not writing a travelogue. You can set your story in Nagasaki and by just a few words, a few lines, give the feeling of being there without describing every event, every pothole, every building. And that was not your purpose in any of it.
No. I'm never particular. As a novelist, I'm not interested in writing down details about the surface textures of places. To me, I'm creating landscapes of the imagination, landscapes that somehow express various themes and emotions that I'm obsessed by. And so I don't see my task as being that of a travel writer or a journalist or someone who tries to convey to Westerners what it's like in Japan or conveys to other people what it's like in England. I mean, I don't see that as my task. I may use these settings that have enormous emotional reverberation for me. But I'm not really concerned to reproduce accurately these kind of small surface details to build up a picture of what a country may look like. I'm much more concerned about its moods, its atmospheres, its emotional intensities.
A Pale View of Hills is an interesting book, not so much for what you have in, but for what you left out. And you have put a certain burden on the reader, I say that in a positive way, to understand what is going on. For example, the woman narrator. We don't know exactly how, if I have not read it, or it's been a while since I've read it, but if I'm not mistaken, we know about her first husband, because she lives with the husband and her father-in-law visits, but she's narrating this from the perspective of being in England. So we know something happened to her first husband, but you don't say what.
Yeah, particularly at the time when I wrote A Pale View of Hills, which is now, I must say, going back 10 years, I was very interested in the technique of using gaps and spaces in fiction to create very powerful vacuums. That's something that I've always used in my later fiction, but I think it's particularly noticeable in my first book there. The reason I'm interested in these gaps, these kind of black holes of information, is because I'm interested in the way people can't face certain things. When people resort to self-deception and tell themselves stories that aren't quite complete about what happened in their past. So what's happening in A Pale View of Hills is that a woman is looking back over her life, and there are some things that are so painful to her that she can't look at them directly. And so instead she starts to tell the reader a story about another woman with another child from way back in the past. And somehow by telling the story of another person, she is able to actually examine certain things that happened to her and her own child. And I notice this is a way of people often operate. They're often talking about a mutual friend or something like that, and you realize they're really talking about themselves.
You could write a second book and make a whole new book out of the gaps that you left out of the first one.
Ah, yes, but that wouldn't it wouldn't be the same book, and it wouldn't
defeat put them
the
together.
Purpose of the, yeah,
no, it wouldn't be the
uh-huh.
same.
No, I mean, this is, you see, I mean, fiction interests me because you know, we all use fiction in our daily lives. I mean, it's not just authors and writers who use fiction. We all need to actually tell ourselves stories about other people we know or people we read about in the news. And we use these stories in a way to furnish our own lives and to examine what we do with our own lives. And we're often talking about somebody else when, and that's a good way to actually try and work out some things about ourselves. This is the way we use fiction. We make up stories about people we know. Of course, we try to stick more or less to the concrete details about what we see happening to them, but how we interpret what's happening to them, the judgments we pass on them, the critical stances we take towards them, these are often conditioned by what is happening to ourselves, what we feel is happening in our own lives.
And when we speak autobiographically, it usually tends to be self-serving, as autobiographies usually are.
Yes, autobiography is often... Yes, it's often a very treacherous and deceptive thing.
Another way of leaving out, putting in gaps in your life that you don't want to either face or discuss among other people.
Yes, I think gaps are a very important part of the way we
black holes.
Look at ourselves. Yes, and so I don't want to exclude them from my work.
I had one. I have a unique position in being able to interrogate an author. One-on-one, I had one piece of confusion. Toward the end of the book, as I recall, let's see, the little girl, the names, I always forget the names, but the little girl the mother is packing. She's about to go off with Frank. At least she thinks she is going to eventually meet Frank back in the United States. She's packing. The little girl runs away. The narrator goes to find her and goes out with a lantern, flashlight. If I can find this.
I think I know the passage you're referring to.
Here.
Yeah.
Here it is, on page 172. Insects followed my lantern as I made my way along the river. And then she begins to talk to the little girl. If you don't like it there, we will come straight back. Now, this confused me, because she seems now to have adopted the role of the little girl's mother.
Yes, it's confused a lot of people, but this is because of this narrative strategy that I was explaining before. This is about a woman who really wants to talk about what happened to her in the past and how she came to bring her own daughter over to England on all these things. We don't quite know what happened, but she doesn't want to examine these very painful things, because many things have ended in tragedy. It's ended in a daughter's suicide and all these things. And so the only way she can actually examine that aspect of her life is by looking at somebody else altogether, somebody else's story that in many key respects resembles her own. And so that's what the main part of the story of A Pale View of Hills is. It's about a woman talking about a friend from the past and her child. But really, her motive in telling that story is to really examine her own story. And so at the end, she forgets that she is supposed to be not talking about herself, that she is talking about somebody else. And the narratives start to overlap there.
Well, I had to go back over that a few times, and I thought I would ask you that. I'm still not quite satisfied with that explanation a little bit. It just, because there's almost another voice in there as a narrator, it seems.
Well, yes, the key to this is, it may be difficult for listeners to follow this discussion if they haven't read the book, but the key to this is the relationship of the narrator, Etsuko, to this woman she is talking about, Sachiko. Are they in fact the same people? And my answer is, not literally. Then, I mean, there probably was another person called Sachiko way back in the past. But when she is telling Sachiko's story, I mean, she's not telling this story because she is fascinated by Sachiko intrinsically. It's because she sees in what happened to Sachiko something that happened to herself. And so for the purposes of this story that she's telling, Sachiko represents her.
And in fact, it entered my mind that perhaps the daughter who committed suicide may have well been the little girl.
But once again,
very disturbed little girl in Nagasaki.
Yeah. But once again, not literally, but yes, in that's why she's telling the story, because here is an instance of a mother and a child that closely parallels what happened in her own life.
You understand, don't you, that while this is 10 years old to you, it is a brand new book for many other people. They're sort of reading it for the first time. So
it's more or less a brand new book here in the United States. Of course, it came out in England and various other countries, and it did actually produce this kind of puzzled effect quite often. It was often said to be a very mysterious book. In fact, the English paperback edition, I think, has got blasted on the back cover, something like words like enigma and stuff like this. And that's the reputation it had. You're not the only person to be slightly baffled by the ending.
When was the book first published in the United States?
In the United States, as a hardback, it came out, I think, the same time it came out in England, back in 1982.
And this was your first?
That's my first book. I was.
And you have a second novel, which I haven't read, that's also set in Japan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And The Remains of the Day is your third book.
That's right.
It's an extraordinary book. I know you've been asked many times how you researched it, how you got into the mind of the butler. But I would imagine that few people would be in a position to challenge your facts. I wonder if we have butlers like that today.
Well, my attitude to that is that I'm not that concerned. If a real butler pops up today and says, look, you've got this and this and this wrong, that's not the way we did things. It would be beside the point. No, because my purpose is not to try and recreate accurately what life was like for a real butler in England in the 1930s. That to me is of very limited interest. All right, some sociologists may be interested, social historians may be interested, but of course I've chosen the figure of a butler for metaphorical reasons. I'm trying to say various things that concern me as a person living in the 1990s, or the 1980s, when I write that book. And I'm talking through the myth created around the figure of the English butler. He's a metaphor for me in various respects.
Can you be a little more specific about that?
Well, of course, I mean, I have no interest in butlers per se. You know, I don't know any butlers. I've never had an ambition to be a butler. I've certainly never had any butlers working in any houses I've ever lived in. I came to the butler via all these themes that I wanted to write about, and I suppose roughly it divides into two things that I wanted to talk about in the book. First was the frustrating feeling I had as somebody who'd grown up in an idealistic time in the late 60s and early 70s, when the younger generation, people of my age, we grew up thinking that we were going to change the world, we had a duty to change the world. And we had a lot of idealistic notions. And I was often involved in many kind of active, politically active groups, and also in voluntary social work fields. But as we got older, things just started to get more and more complicated. And today I sense that this is something that very much is a burden on many of us. And this is the emotion I was trying to convey, was that here I am, somebody who is supposed to be educated, somebody with a certain sense of responsibility, living in a democratic country. I have this notion that it's up to people like me, ultimately, to decide on the big questions, how the country is run, the decisions the government makes, because that's what it means to be a citizen in a democratic country. And yet, on the other hand, I became more and more conscious how ignorant I was about many of the most burning, key, important issues of the day. I cannot really talk in a very intelligent way about world economics, science and technology, international diplomacy, ecology. Of course, I have a smattering of knowledge from what I pick up in newspapers and stuff like that. But here I am, somebody with two university degrees, you know, a lot of time to read and think, and yet I know that I am very incompetent. I only have the nominal knowledge and expertise in the most crucial areas. And yet I have this responsibility as a member of a democracy. And this seems to me one of the paradoxes we live in democratic societies. And most of us, I felt, you know, we don't really get into a position where we run things. What we do is we just kind of do a little job. We just get on with our small lives and hope for the best, that the little things that we accomplish will somehow filter up there into the big important world and contribute to something we would approve of. But most of us, we don't head governments or lead coup d'etats. What we do is we do a job, we work for an employer or organization or maybe some cause, political cause, and we just do a little thing. We hope that somebody up there, upstairs, uses our little contribution in a good way. In other words, we're rather like butlers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we, and so I ended up with this figure of the butler. He knows how to serve tea, and he takes great pride in how he can run a household. But he says, look, I'm just a butler. I can't make these big decisions about how we run the world. But I'll get some dignity from saying that I'm serving a master, a great man, who does know all about these big things. And he abandons responsibility over his political life. And his tragedy is that the person he's working for is a Nazi sympathizer. But this is the feeling I was trying to convey. But the other attraction of a butler for me is that, certainly in England, and I found most places in the world, the figure of the butler stands for a certain kind of ridiculous, pompous, stiff, emotionally constipated caricature of a human being. And when people try to emulate butlers, that's what they try to do. They try to behave in a way that seems to cancel out anything that's kind of spontaneous and human. And I wanted very much in this book to talk about emotional suppression, the tendency to mistake, the tendency to equate expressing emotion with weakness. And I think this is something that is a very strong trait in English society and Japanese society. And possibly the male sex are more prone to do this than the female sex. But I wanted to talk about that area in all people, that arena that we're all most scared of, which is the emotional arena, the place where we really put our emotions at risk, our feelings, that those things that are, that's the most scary arena of all. And in the remains of the day, I tried to paint the portrait of a man who, by pretending that he's being utterly professional, by pretending that he's seeking out some sort of special dignity, is really just hiding. It's just really cowardice. He just retreats and hides from that really scary arena of human relations.
Does Stevens actually see the love emanating from the housekeeper, who was probably the most charming character in the book? Or does he retreat? Does he see it and ignore it, or is he oblivious to it?
I think he, somewhere deep down, he sees it, and that's why he's so scared. He's a man very, very scared of love. And that's why he puts up this incredible alibi, really, of saying that he is this dedicated professional butler, and it is the duty of the butler not to have any emotions. And to him, that's a kind of a professional perfection. But what I'm suggesting, what Stevens comes to realize right at the end of the book, is that it's a very hollow achievement. And in fact, it's not an achievement at all. It's just a cowardice, just a way of running away from the really challenging, really scary part of being a human being.
In a way, the villagers that he encounters toward the end of the book have it, as they say, more altogether than Stevens, as they gather in that living room and they talk politics, and they seem to be much more of a part of society than Stevens would allow himself to be.
Yes, and I think he starts to understand from his contact with people like these villagers that there is another definition of dignity. And the one that is offered to him by these particular villagers discussing politics is the dignity that comes from being a democratic citizen, the ability to control, to some extent, your own fate. But that only comes if you actually accept the responsibility and participate. So he starts to actually have this other notion of dignity, to challenging his own notion of dignity. Up till then, he thinks dignity is just behaving like a butler in this kind of very stiff, unruffled way, which he begins to see towards the end of the book is a very empty and shallow definition of the word.
The book is also very, very funny. Sometimes you can I think some critics may overlook that fact, but I can see George Bernard Shaw picking up the silver and marveling at the shine and the luster. I mean, that was a very funny part of the book. There's a lot of humor in this book, and it's poignant too. But it's very funny, and also the language. I love your use of language. When I first started reading it, I said to myself, "Boy, this is really stiff." He said, "I'm not going to like this book. This language is so stilted." And then I realized that you had developed the voice of this character, that is the same all the way through the book. I mean, it was a very deliberate effort to get into the mind of this man and to use his voice. Which is a hard thing to do.
I guess it is, but it's a technique you use as a writer. I've always used first-person narrative. And for me, the great advantage of using a narrator, who is also the central character, is that you tell readers what that character is like, not just through what happens to him and what he says and does to other characters, but just through the tone of his voice, those words that are there on the page. And so I think a very subtle relationship is created between the reader and the central character. If the central character is the person actually telling the story. And so, yeah, for that book, I try to write the whole thing in kind of butler speak. So that the actual language, the way he struggled in the way he used his language, just to keep a hold of his emotions, just to keep in control and not lose control, would actually support the theme of the book. And so the language itself is the language of somebody who's afraid of the human in him. He always uses these words that keeps his opinions and emotions at a distance.
Now, when you began to write The Remains of the Day, you spoke philosophically in using this as a metaphor, that here's someone, a small part of life, you know, and not part of the big picture, doing what he has to do. But wasn't it really an effort to write a story, tell a story, or storyteller? I mean, does someone like yourself sit down before the typewriter or wood processor, whatever you use, and say, I'm going to write a bunch, this is going to be a metaphor for life, or can you just tell a story?
I do that. What I do is I always start with theme, and that's the controlling factor for me. It probably happens to a lot of authors. People come up to you and say, look, this funny thing happened to me, and they tell you this little anecdote that happened to them, and they say, I thought I'd tell it to you because you're an author and you might be able to use it. And this quite often happens to me, and often what they tell me is quite an interesting little anecdote with an interesting twist or something like this. But it's usually of no concern to me. It's of no interest to me whatsoever, unless I think I can use that piece of narrative to express one of the themes I am obsessed by. In other words, I'm not interested in plot for its own sake. For me, it's plot is just one of the many tools an author has to express a certain thing. And so for me, I always start with the question, what is this book going to be about? What are the themes I'm going to explore? I know I'm not talking about a clear message. You know, I think there's nothing more boring than books with messages. But theme is something else. You're asking questions about certain areas. You're saying, what about this? What about that? A debate of some sort with myself. And I find it very important to maintain some kind of discipline in my writing, so that all these things like plot, character, all these other things you put into a book, all serve clearly what you want these things to serve. That is the expression of the theme, exploration of the theme.
When you began writing The Remains of the Day, did you know where you were going? The reason I asked that question, one very fine novelist, Bobby Ann Mason, was telling me that when she starts a story, she sometimes has a line, just a line, or just an image. For example, she wrote a wonderful short story that became a very complex story about a family, but it started simply because of an image of bees flying into an attic. And then it just started from there. She didn't have an idea where she was going to go. It seems to me that's kind of a hard way to write, but I think some people do it. But in your case, how do you approach a book like that?
I know many writers who write like that. I'm a great admirer of Bobby Ann Mason's work. And many of my friends in England and elsewhere in the world who are writers, I know, work probably closer to Bobby Ann Mason's way of working than my way of working. At one extreme, you have these writers who just put in a blank piece of paper into a typewriter or whatever it is they use. They have no idea what's going to tumble out. And they kind of improvise, and all kinds of strange, dark things sometimes surface on the page. And then they look at that, and then they edit it, shape it. They start to use their conscious, artistic mind and shape it. Now, I can't work like that. It's just a temperamental thing. I always have to have a clear map of where I'm going before I start to write the actual words that end up in a book. So I spend a lot of time planning and researching. Now, by researching, I don't necessarily mean the kind of research a journalist or non-fiction writer would do. But I have to actually research that fictional landscape in my mind where the book is going to take place. I have to know fairly thoroughly what the characters are going to be like, what their relationships are like, what the moods and atmospheres of the fictional world I'm going to be writing about are like. I have to get all that right. I spend often 2 years, you know, planning a book, filling up folder after folder with notes and diagrams before I actually start to write the actual prose.
I'm sorry, say that again, 2 years?
Yeah, it remains the day it took me 3 years to write. The book before that also took 3 years to write. In each case, I think I spent 2 years planning and just 1 year writing the prose.
So you had 2 years of planning and 1 year of actual writing.
Yeah, the actual writing is not, for me, the problem. You know, I've got to a point where I'm fairly technically competent to be able to write the words without too much of an effort. It takes time because there's a lot of words. But for me, the real challenge, the difficult bit, is to get the thing in shape in my head, to have those, to have the ideas and have that fictional world built up in my head. That's the real challenge for me. And then when I know that world very well, I can then do the words. You know, that's something that doesn't bother me too much.
I was interviewing the novelist Edward Abbey, who died last year. He was telling me that someone came up to him once and said, "How long does it take for you to write a novel?" And Abbey said, "A lifetime." I thought that was a wonderful response because, in a way, the sum total of everything you have learned and understood about people and yourself goes into what you write.
Yes, that's absolutely right, I think. You know, I think when I say it took me 3 years to write the book, of course, if I was confined to just the experiences of those 3 years, you know, I would write something retarded.
I doubt that will ever happen. Well, what are you working on now?
Well, the problem is that the book industry has become such that if you actually have anything like a success with a book, it's very difficult to start work on your next one because you spend a lot of your time traveling around the world, supporting one publication after another. Because what happens is that you write a book and then it comes out in various different countries at different times in different editions in different languages. And often you go to those places. And I've spent the best part of the last year and a half just traveling.
Well, that goes with the territory. It's what William Kennedy won the Pulitzer Prize for his novel Ironweed. He says that's giving the book its due.
Well, I find the whole process of traveling fascinating, and I enjoy it, you know. But at some point, I suppose I have to go back and lead a much more dull life in my study writing.
I would assume that you're writing when you're not writing.
I hope so. That's what I tell myself when I'm...
Well, the 2 years of preparation before you actually started to write is an indication that you probably are always working. Today, for example, on my way here, I was waiting at a stoplight, and I overheard there were two young girls talking. One girl was saying to the other, she said, "And he's been so upset. He has locked himself in his room, and he won't come out. And we banged on the door, but he refuses to come out, and we don't know what to do." And then the light changed, and I began to think about that, you know. And that was just a thread of conversation, somebody locking himself in the room, depressed, obviously, won't come out. And I began to think, you know, I'll probably be thinking about that for a long time. Maybe I'll write something down about that. I mean, if you had heard that, maybe you would have salted that away in your mind somehow. Or an image that is in your mind from some distant time, you will elaborate on it mentally as you flew across the Atlantic. I mean, doesn't that happen to you?
Oh, of course, all the time, and particularly if you travel to foreign countries. So many things that the natives of that country may take for granted strike you as odd or interesting or perhaps sometimes gives you a really profound insight into the way the world works. And so that kind of thing is happening all the time, and I would hope that it's all digesting somewhere, and it may be of use to me, either as a human being or as a writer. But there comes a point, if you're a writer, and this is the difference between just people who travel all the time and people who are writers, I guess, so there comes a point for a writer when you actually sit down and try to shape things out of your experience. You try to structure things. And that's why some people are artists and other people aren't. The former category has this strange urge every now and again to retreat into some dull little room and try and put all this together, all these different images, all these different insights, all these different ideas, and try and bang something into shape.
Such willpower it must take for a writer to go into the privacy of his room and do something without anyone standing over his shoulder. I have to come to work here every day. Every day. I have certain duties in the newsroom. I have to write for this newscast. And I have to be here at certain times. And then I pick up a paycheck at the end of the week. But for a writer not to be told to do anything, you just do it.
I think for many writers, it's not so much willpower, it's this obsession. I mean, they don't miss for one moment somebody standing over their shoulder. There's something deep inside them that makes them carry on with this weird, strange, antisocial activity of sitting in a room on their own, banging out a book. And I've often asked myself, why do writers, in many other respects, perfectly well-balanced social beings, why do they do this? And there are some people who do this without making any money. They ruin their marriages, they ruin their jobs because they go home at night and insist on writing. It's not just the professional writers who do this. This is a very, very strong urge.
In fact, most writers in this country don't make any money.
Some people do.
Well, a few of them do.
I've run into a few who make a lot of money. But yes, I think that this is the money thing is often a red herring. Obviously, in every society, in every age, there have been people who have felt this need to somehow get down and try and make sense of things through the written word. And I think it's got nothing to do with... All right, sometimes it's to do with money. Sometimes it's to do with people imposing artificial deadlines. But what keeps this whole writing game going is I think this is a very natural, deeply rooted mechanism that human beings have. That when the world just appears slightly out of balance, if there's something wrong somewhere, the only consolation you can give yourself is perhaps to actually try and create your own fictional alternative or to present your own vision of things. I've looked at a lot of other writers and I've tried to ask myself, what do they have in common? What do all these weird people who do this strange thing, what do they have in common? And I've come to this conclusion that most writers, and I suppose I have to include myself in this, somewhere deep down they are slightly unbalanced. Now, I don't mean they're crazy people. some writers are the most responsible, nice people I've come across anywhere. But somewhere very deep and fundamental in their experience of life, maybe something in their childhood, something didn't quite match up, and they know that there's nothing they can do about it now. And I think they go over this wound over and over again in their writing. Some do it through painting, some do it through music. But it's the only, as I say, it's the only kind of consolation people have when they realize that something has gone fundamentally wrong. Some equilibrium has been lost somewhere way back and you can never retrieve it. But it's a consolation. You build your own worlds. You try to say, well, maybe the world is like this, or maybe it's your attempt to just go over something that can never really be gone over.
Well, it's an artistic impulse, and nobody has been able to understand it, explain it. The attempt to be creative has never been understood.
Sometimes it's just straight egotism, of course. People want attention.
Well, I think most people want some attention. I think we all have egos that it's necessary just to go through life. You have to have some degree of success, or even a little, success, like making the green light.
Mm-hmm.
just little things can sometimes make your day. Well, we could go on forever. I can ask you a lot of other questions, but our time is up. These are beautiful books. I'm glad that... These are the first paperbacks, aren't they, of each?
That's correct, yes.
And they just came out, right?
Mm-hmm.
Ran in, so well. Those people who have missed your work in the past, I think will benefit from these Vintage International paperbacks. It's a wonderful way to expose your work. Is the second book, is that in print here?
That's also in Vintage, yeah. That was published last year. It's a Vintage paperback.
I'm going to have to dig that one up. But you haven't started on a new one yet.
No, as I say, I've been traveling around the world too much to actually.
I've got 3 years to work. I better make sure I'm pronouncing your name right. Kazuo.
Yeah, that's not bad.
Ishiguro.
That's not bad.
It's not bad.
Not bad for
American. Like I've been speaking Japanese for years. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.